1 Thessalonians chapter 5, we left off in verse 12. Now, I prepared about 10 pages worth of follow-up to the previous study on the rapture. And the more deeper I got into it, the more technical it became, and the more I realized how, man, I would just bore the living daylights out of some of you if I covered some of that. So, here's what I'm going to do. I'm actually going to kind of fine-tune those notes, some other points on the subject, show the various views of where the rapture possibly can be, because again, remember, this is just a family debate, and then post them up on my blog, LloydPulley.com. We'll get them up there, and then you can kind of peruse through, check out the scriptures, check out the points for those of you who really want to dig into it deeper, but not for the point of arguing or debating or getting, you know, really antsy about this sort of thing, because, you know, at the end of the day, there's great people. I actually enjoy reading some of the people that on the other side of the debate who believe in post-tribulational rapture view and others. Good people. They've got their points. I don't happen to agree with them. I believe the rapture will happen before, not because I'm some escapist. I want to get in the escape pod before the trouble comes. It has nothing to do with it. It's really just a matter of a theological position that I hold. It fits best the literal interpretation of the Bible. And I really believe that it is the way the Lord is doing it. But I may be wrong. At the end of the day, it's not worth the big fight and hassle about. And I do love sometimes, at least in the last decade, there have been some lively debates on the areas of end times and eschatology without turning rancorous and with a real bad attitude. So I've really appreciated that. But for now, we left off in verse 12 of 1 Thessalonians 5. And what I appreciate about this remaining section, which we will not cover all tonight, because though there are just a few verses, they're pregnant with exhortation, encouragement. In fact, you know, when we see what Paul has exhorted a few times to the Thessalonians, he complimented them about their love and their faith and their hope. Then he exhorts them about love and faith and hope. And now, interestingly enough, he, in his final exhortations, talks about practical love, practical faith, practical hope. In other words, let's get down to just get it out of the theological section of the clouds and bring it into how does the rubber meet the road? How does this work through our lives? So, we left in verse 12, he says, "And we urge you, brethren." Paul uses that word a lot to these young believers at Thessalonica. Remember what I believe is the first book written. I never mentioned that some believe Galatians may be, but it's probable that this was the very first letter, the very first writing of the New Testament. Before the Gospels, before Acts, before any of the other epistles, this was written to this young group of people that Paul reached out to in his missionary journey, the very first one, in which he could only be 3 weeks with them and then had to, you know, get out of town quick because of the persecution. But those he left grew. You know, that excites me. When I think about people that come here on a Wednesday night, you know, you've had a busy week. I know my week has been crazy busy. You're tired, you're exhausted, yet you're here. There's a hunger. And you know what? It's because God has touched you. You have experienced Him. And you want to know more. You want to grow. You want to get deeper. You want to get to meet other people and get plugged in. And man, God is going to meet you in a special way. So tonight, it's this urging of Paul follows up on his exhortation about love, faith, and hope. And he starts out really what I call practical love or practicing love. "And we urge you, brethren, to recognize those who labor among you and are over you in the Lord and admonish you." Now some read that at first and think, "over you in the Lord." Wait a minute, doesn't Galatians 3:28 say that, you know, we're all one? We're all equal. There's no hierarchy. There's no someone's not better than someone else. Absolutely. It's like in a marriage. Is a wife less of a person than a husband just because the husband is called to be the head of the home? Of course not. Does a position of submission, whether it be as an employee or as a wife or as someone in whatever authority structure there is, does that make you less of a person? Absolutely not. Leadership is a gift in the church for the blessing of the church.
In fact, that's the whole concept that Jesus drives home with his disciples in his three and a half years of training those 12, is that leaders by example, servant leadership, where instead of the top of the pyramid where you're lording over everybody, you invert it and you realize that you are at the bottom rower of the ship, the servant, and you're undergirding everyone else. A servant exists to make somebody else's life easier. And that's what leaders, pastors, servants, elders should see themselves as. We're here not to exult in a position and walk around and strut around as if we're something. Rather, we recognize the Lord has given us this precious opportunity to encourage the saints to unleash themselves and their gifts and to grow in what they're supposed to be, that they be a blessing to others, one stone upon another stone upon another stone, and we're all working together to influence the world with one voice and one mind and one heart to trust in Jesus Christ for salvation, which is eternal. And so we've got to see this. But here he says to recognize. Now the word to recognize literally in the Greek means to know them, which implies by in this context to respect or appreciate what they're doing. Those who labor, in our case, you know, obviously, as a senior pastor here, I cannot possibly even pretend to mentor each person here that attends this fellowship and calls this fellowship their home. But I can tell you this, the only reason you call this place your home, for most of you, it should be that you found your niche here, that yes, you enjoy the teaching and you worship the Lord together in praise and psalms and you serve together, but there is that mentoring going on, some that you look up to, that you've been touched by. There are close to a dozen other men that full-time assist me in this ministry. There are over 30 or close to 30 elders. And those are just the official ones. You know, I have to recognize that whether or not we have officially recognized an elder here in this body, there are probably dozens more of men here that are elding, that are admonishing, they're encouraging, they're discipling. You know, they've done it so well, they haven't even been noticed in a sense. You know, they haven't been recognized because they're not tooting their own horn. They're just serving quietly and faithfully and ministering. There are so many other ministry leaders and many behind the scenes that are essentially all a part of this, those who are laboring among you. You'd be amazed how many people are involved, actively concerned for your souls, and that serve in their niche and serve in their part to minister to you. And that's how it should be. Now, you know, the interesting thing is the question you could ask is, who is it that I would go to when I'm really hurting? Who is it that washes my feet? And who is it that challenges me to go further with the Lord? Who is it that I call when I have a question? You know, those are the people really that would fit in this category. This isn't just about the senior pastor by any stretch. Those who labor among you. By the way, the word labor here is working to exhaustion. You know, I had to think about this week and was just for the fun of it, kind of logging hours, and I never think about that normally because I enjoy what I do so much, I don't think of it as work, but just for the fun of it, I was logging the hours, and I realized now I'm really tired after I see the hours that I put in. But you know what, it's funny because this is what it should be, laboring, working to exhaustion. And believe it or not, it is hard work. I don't know what people's concept is of the senior pastors, but sometimes people, you know, wonder, what do you do all week, Pastor? You know, I see you up in the Sunday mornings and Wednesdays, you know, and what do you do the rest of the week? Golf and hang out? And yeah, if that were the case, my staff would actually love me because every time around, they get more work. But, you know, the funny thing is, I look at the staff here and the group here as a skeleton crew, really, to a skeleton crew trying to mobilize large numbers of you to serve, get involved, get plugged in, get discipled, stirring up one another. So it's really, there is a lot of labor. It's a labor of love, though. And so he says he urges those to recognize those who labor among you and are over you in the Lord and admonish you. Over you in the sense as in guiding and caring for. You know, that's the kind of over you that the Bible speaks about. When he even calls, even the by definition, the term bishop, which is a transliteration, actually, of the Greek word in a way. The episkopos, it's kind of like the bishop. It's really overseer, and an overseer is one who's laid the charge to that person is for those people the Lord has put in his care and his trust. And in a sense, he is there to guide and to protect and to care for. He's got to be apt to teach. He's got to have his personal life in order, because if you don't rule well in your own house, how can you rule in the church of God? You've got to be an example of the believer. So these guys, essentially, what Paul is urging is that the body in general appreciate the labor that is put into the making of disciples and those whom the Lord has raised up. And again, over you in the Lord is really kind of an interesting picture. Jesus modeled servant leadership. And of course, the word admonish you is instructing you in what you're to do. Hebrews 13, the author also expresses it in verse 7, remember those who rule over you and have spoken the word of God to you, whose faith follow, considering the outcome of their conduct. It's kind of an interesting thing, because Paul even says, follow me as I follow the Lord. And here's the example. I want to live in such a way that it's not just the words, you know, because most of the time I'm at a disadvantage with so many of you who don't know me personally, that you see me as a talking head and you see me up here and talking, but you don't know my personal life. The disadvantage is that I only have half of the ability to make a difference in your life or influence you. Because when it really gets tough in your life and you're really, you know, put at it, it's the people that are closest to you that are really going to have the greatest influence on you. And that's why you want to surround yourself with really godly people, with people that are passionate about the Lord and are serious about those things. And, you know, when you're serious about the Lord, you also don't take yourself too seriously. Sometimes people get all lifted up and about position, and really it's not about position. So he goes on to speak about this, to esteem them very highly in love, verse 13, for their work's sake. And that's really the key. It's for their work's sake, not their position's sake. I don't think positions should be honored per se. Because if a person gets a position or the title of a pastor or an elder or a deacon or whatever, what is that? What is a position if there's not a function that goes with it? See, if someone isn't functioning, I know sometimes when someone gets their credentials, quote-unquote, for the pastorate and gets pastor in front of their name, if they don't, they're not really pastoring. What's that? Or someone gets to be an elder. I'm an elder of the church. Really, who are you elding? It's really about what you're doing in the Lord. And so the idea is, by definition, it's for their work's sake. Now, Hebrews also goes on to say, obey those who rule over you and be submissive, for they watch out for your souls. That is a key component to a leader. You really care about people. You're watching out for their souls. You know, and I think that's probably the most significant thing about ministry is Jesus came to save, to seek and to save that which is lost. He came to save souls. Because they will live for eternity. Your body's going to die. Go into the ground, worms are going to eat it, it's going to be dust. You will live on. You can have an influence on someone temporarily by helping them here or there, but eternally by making an impact on them. And this is what a leader should be. And the idea is they're follow their faith. Now, when he says, watch, obey those who rule over you and you're watching out for their souls, I think, here's the thing, you know, there's a lot that goes on into just the organization of making sure people get in here and are able to, in an undistracted way, hear the word of the Lord. Listen how silent it is. I think that's an amazing thing, because there's a lot of people in this room. Now, if there were children here, you would only catch probably every other word that I'm saying. And they certainly would be bored spitless, having to listen to this talking head up here for that long and not fidget in their seats. But there are people laboring next door in the children's church that are actually just loving the opportunity they can get to minister and to impact your children. We have never had to twist arms to, oh, we need more people in the children's ministry. Now, from time to time, there might be a lull, you know. There are certain seasons that a number of people that are doing it need to do something else, and we need some more in there, and we'll say, hey, there's some opportunities. But, you know, beyond saying there's opportunities, it's amazing. Because the people that are over there, you couldn't pay them for what they do. They love it. It's an amazing thing. Because they get to minister to those children. And those children, you know, when they come back, you know, you as a parent, you know if your kids enjoy something, if they learn something, if they're into it. In fact, if they were crying, I don't want to go back to those places, those people are mean to me. You know, something's wrong back there. But, you know, the very fact is they're learning about Jesus at their level, and they're growing, and they're being encouraged. And you can sit here in an undistracted way. I think it's wonderful. There are certain models that just hate what we do here. They think we divide families and, you know, we're mean and cruel because we don't allow the children to come in here and make a fuss, and everybody should just get over it. And it's okay to have crying babies in the sanctuary. What's the problem? And, you know, there is a model that people like that. And, well, if you like that, there are churches that provide that for you. So, as the Lord leads. But, you know, here's the thing. This is what we do. And so, you know, naturally you have the organization, which means leadership, which means, well, you know what, we encourage you to take your children into there, or we encourage you for this, or turn your cell phones off, or, you know, other things like that, just so that there's this wonderful silence. You can actually hear the Word of God. You can meditate. You can ponder it. Your mind is clear to think in an undistracted way. I think that's an amazing thing. So he says, to esteem them very highly in love. Now, I love that part in verse 13 because when I look at Jesus' ministry, you know, when I watch him with the disciples, and now that I'm actually going through Mark, I'm observing Jesus more closely from the standpoint of putting myself in the shoes of one of those disciples. And, you know, for a long time, I looked at Jesus like, you know, he's around these disciples. He's like, oh, are these guys idiots? You know, oh, ye of little faith, you know. And I always looked at Jesus, how it must have been for him to be around those disciples. But you see, I'm reading my own impatience in that. And of course, could you ever say Jesus was impatient? Of course not. He was the epitome of patience. You know, amazing thing is he actually, and the more I look at it, he really, really enjoyed the company of those disciples. They weren't the bigwigs of the town. They were fishermen, tax collectors, zealots. You know, they had a variety of backgrounds and temperaments. You would never have been able to get them in the same room in any normal circumstance. But here they were following Jesus, and he enjoyed them. By the time he's saying goodbye to them in John 13, and he's washing their feet, and says, you know, I've longed to have this Last Supper with you. That was our Lord and Savior. He longed for that fellowship, that encouragement. As a man, he enjoyed that. And you know, I think there's a lot to be said about this esteeming very highly in love. You see, that's how I would want it to be. I want you to know that for those that I can mentor and encourage and bless on a personal level, I am mutually encouraged like you can't believe. I am so lifted up by so many of the prayers of people in this fellowship. Because certainly when you look at the labor and when you look at the challenge of a leader, one of the biggest challenges most people wouldn't guess is that you pretty much are a lightning rod for Satan. You're a target. I mean, if Satan could bring me down, stumble me, cause me to sin, how many lives that would affect? Now, granted, most of you who have your eyes in the Lord would keep moving on in the Lord and just say, well, you know, he blew it. Too bad for him. Next. But, you know, the point is that it still would affect a lot of younger believers and people that, at least in the interim time, you know, look to those leaders to make that example. And when they fail, there's a lot of people get shipwrecked. So Satan would love to bring down myself or any leader in this fellowship so that he could get all of the little emissaries going, aha, see, they're all hypocrites, and discourage people from believing in the Lord. So I'm a lightning rod for that. But you know what? I also have a lot of mutual encouragement as people have esteemed me highly in love and pray for me and truly know that the challenge is there. And I am so grateful for that. So I can be crazy busy and exhausted and yet buoyed up by the mutual faith of so many. So esteem them highly in love for their work's sake and be at peace among yourselves. That is the idea. Stop striving. This isn't about position. This isn't about getting recognized. This isn't about any of those things. Think of Jesus who ministered and was ministered to by His disciples and thoroughly did enjoy them. So here we have this picture. Now, verse 14 says, "Now we exhort you." So He addresses their attitude toward their leaders in verse 12 and 13. Now in verse 14, it's kind of hard to discern whether He's addressing leaders and what they're supposed to be doing because we exhort you, brethren, or this actually gives us an insight into the fact that every one of us, in some way or another, have the charge of others around us. You might be a believer that's just 3 weeks old in the Lord. But maybe you brought one of your friends who's just 1 week old in the Lord. In a way, you have a charge for them. That you're to seek the Lord so that you can encourage them. And you're always, always have to be thinking in terms of who you can influence and encourage. Otherwise, what are you doing? When Peter says we're all living stones being built up together into this holy habitation of God, the idea is that God is right here present with us. We're all one body, and that's one illustration. Of course, there are many missing body parts in the church today. Can you imagine a church that would try to exist with some of the liver cells going astray or some of the heart cells going astray? Well, that's what happens in the church body when people don't find their gift and realize how they can employ it in serving others. So here's the challenge for all of us. To really look to see how we can uphold each other. And this is where He gets the exhortation, I think, right on down to every believer. And we're all responsible for these things. Check them out. Pretty wild. He says, "Brethren, I exhort you, brethren, warn those who are unruly." All right, let's talk about that for a moment. Warn the unruly. Who are the unruly? Well, the word is a word that simply, it's a word in Greek. Anytime you have a word with a on the front of a word, it means the opposite of that word. Where if you have theist, which is a Greek word for, you know, God or belief in God, when you put an a in front of it, atheist, that is, I don't believe in God. When you have a word that's in front of it like that, most of the time. So you have this word particularly that is an A in front of a word that it means to follow rank or to be in rank or be organized in a way. So here would be someone that's very unorganized with their life, not just in the sense of time management, not just in the sense of, gee, you know, they've got a cluttered house. This is about unorganized in their own walk with God. In other words, not disciplined. And He says, warn them. Now, what do you warn them? Well, the idea is, if they continue in an undisciplined state, you know, because the very word lasciviousness is a sense, it's a word that basically is unrestrained pleasure seeking. That's where the world is right now. They're lascivious. And it's really the opposite of one who would have an order and a discipline in their life. Now, Paul the Apostle writes about that in his own experience. I want you to turn to this passage because I think it really bears mention in this context. In 1 Corinthians chapter 9, he gives a good illustration in verse 24. And he says, "Do you not know that those who run in a race all run, but one receives the prize? Run in such a way that you may obtain it. And everyone who competes for the prize is temperate in all things." Now that would be a good word that would be a synonym for being disciplined. It's temperate. "Now they do it to obtain a perishable crown." You know, when a person competes in athletics, the rigors they put their body through, the discipline, the regimen is amazing. Especially if you compete on a high level such as the Olympics. I mean, every molecule of food is carefully calculated. And, you know, when I think about that kind of a discipline, when you think of a race that someone's running, someone's competing, someone's temperate, every regiment of their life is calculated out for the desired results. And, you know, the funny thing is they do it for a perishable crown. I think back in my wrestling days, I got to tell you, it makes me laugh when I think of the amount of torture that I put my body through so that I could get a little medal in a tournament. And I was beaten up, and all I have it for these little medals that even if I brought them out, you wouldn't care. You wouldn't go, oh, look at that. Whoopee. Nobody cares. And yet, the funny thing is, what do we do that for? For an imperishable crown. But, you know, when you think about what's at stake with your life in the Lord, to exercise some control and discipline, you don't even know what's at stake. And that's what I think about when he says, warn the unruly. Look, we need that discipline. We need to get in, fall in rank, fall in that place where the Lord has called us to be. And because wherever we are, no matter how old you've been in the Lord, you know someone is depending upon you. And, you know, we think about sin so often wrongly. It's like, oh, what I'm not doing wrong. But we fail to see some of the greatest sins that we commit are the sins of omission, what we're not doing, what we should be doing. And by not being there, the impact of that on others' lives. Think of parents who don't realize how important it is to set that example. That kids, see, you can teach them all the things you want to teach them.
Think about this. You're a dad and you tell your kids, you know, do this, do this, do this. You don't realize what they really do pick up is what you do. That's what they see. And what do you love? What are you excited about? What lights you up? That's what's going to light them up. So you see these kids, you know, wearing these jerseys of these sports teams, and this is great. Man, this is their identity. Why? Because they get that from their parents. Nothing wrong with sports. But do you have that same fire and passion for the things of God? If you don't, there's no way they can catch what you don't have. There's no way. You want your kids to grow up spiritual and have the Lord and put Him in the center and avoid all those things that they could get involved in as they get older. What kind of passion have you shown them? So the sin of omission is deadly. You've heard the illustration, for the lack of a screw, a gun was lost. For the lack of a gun, a skirmish was lost. For the loss of the skirmish, a battle was lost. That loss of a battle, a war was lost. For the loss of a war, freedom was sacrificed. All for the lack of a screw. And, you know, I think that's what it comes down to for us. We don't think that our part is important. Let me tell you something. Every single person that comes to the Lord has pulled him into this family, this body. That's really what it is. It's a family where there's a genuine care for one another. There should be. And if there's a coldness, it's because we're missing something. God forbid if we ever have this cold fellowship among us where we get into our little cliques and new people come in and we don't have room for anybody. And I remember someone telling me they went to one place, just the wildest thing. And they tried to make some friends and they met this couple. And after the first time of getting together, the couple told them, well, we're really not taking any new friends at this time in our lives. And I thought, I heard that and I thought, oh my goodness, I don't think I've ever heard anything like that in my life. Wow. Just by your reaction, it encourages me that would never be you. That we would never look at ourselves as that way, but God would just work in our hearts. And you know what? This is really where we are. Now, stone upon stone, this is where we are. What warned the unruly? Some are not in the place where they need to be. We need to warn them. What they're going to miss is really what the warning is. Not threaten them. The idea of warning someone isn't to threaten, isn't to, you know, manipulate them or, you know, put some guilt trip on them. Really, it's a pitiful thing. What are they missing? I think of people that miss out on a move of the Spirit of God in their life for the sake of just some worldly entertainment. And, you know, there's times when I'm busy studying and sometimes I'll need a break and I'll watch something on TV and it'll be like, some worthless, not a bad show. I don't watch bad stuff. But it'll be some worthless thing. You know, it's like maybe MMA stuff, you know what I mean? I confess. And I look at this and it's like, this is not helping me. In fact, one night I remember I watched about an hour of this stuff. I had like 3 hours taped and I fast forwarded and just got it all in 1 hour. But I was full of all this stuff and I went to bed that night. And I woke up about 4 in the morning. And man, I tell you, the Lord, the Holy Spirit just spoke to my heart that last hour before going to bed, what I put in my heart and my mind and my spirit, it stuck with me. And I woke up with this sense of, you know, panic in a way, spiritually. Oh God, I need your presence. I don't want it. I don't want that in my life. And I think that's true, you know, in many ways, whatever it takes to help encourage those that are not disciplined in their life, because you might look at that and think, oh, you know, you're really legalistic or, you know, over-spiritualizing something. Hey, that's something, because the more you taste of the Lord, the less that stuff in the world is really going to be meaningful to you. That doesn't mean you can't enjoy it. Jesus, you know, he was called a wine bibber and a glutton because he hung around with people, because he loved people and he's right there with them. He wasn't like a monk in a monastery somewhere. And that's not really what he's saying. What he's saying is that there is a discipline that we need to encourage others to take those steps. I can think of some natural things, some essentials. What would be essential for a young believer? Getting into the Word of God, which is essential for an older believer. If you're not in the Word of God on a regular daily basis, you don't know what you're missing. You don't know how all open to attack you are. You don't know how that's going to affect your states of mind and subject your emotions to temptations and struggles that you're not prepared for just by not being equipped in His Word. So I want to warn you in that, what you're missing out. Prayer. You know, depending upon the Lord in prayer. So many times when I pray, I sense doors open. Things that were ordinarily closed, hard, impossible to pass, the Lord makes a way. And it might be in your family, it might be situations in your job, might be situations you're facing in ministry. You have no idea the power of prayer. So those are essential. Fellowship. And getting around others, you see, because we all realize we need each other more than we think. I couldn't live alone. I mean, if the Lord called me somewhere, yes. I mean, He'd be my all in all. But what a joy it is to have fellow sojourners on the road together, encouraging one another. It makes your step much lighter, that fellowship. And then, of course, our witness. Our witness to the world. How essential that is. We cannot let that falter. See, the problem with Christians that have been Christians for over 10 years is they pretty much don't have that many worldly friends. And the problem with that is now you really don't know many unbelievers and you really don't have many opportunities because you kind of like surrounded yourself with Christians, which is good in the beginning, but you want to break out of that to be able to take steps of faith to reach out to others around you. You never know. So in every one of these things, I think, warn the unruly, he expresses, I think, covers these basic disciplines in our life. Then he says, comfort the faint-hearted. You know, that's an encouragement to all of us. There are some that are naturally not as adept to cope with frustration or setbacks as others. You know, some people just cave. They you know, emotionally, they can't handle, you know, something that happens that maybe someone else it wouldn't affect them at all. And it really sets them back. And they get despondent. They get into a kind of a depression. They're more prone to those mood swings. The word in the Greek, you know, in some of the translations is feeble-minded, but it's not meant to speak disparagingly about someone. Some people's constitution in the beginning, I know emotionally, I was very, very sensitive when I first became a Christian. And it was just little things would set me into a depression. And I think there are people like that. And I thank God for those around me that were basically there to comfort me, to encourage me and say, hey, it's all right, man. It's all right. That's normal. You know, when we go through those battles and those challenges, to have somebody next to you and to go, you know what? What you're going through is normal. You're not abnormal right now. I mean, for a long time, for a whole year when I was in California, new to the church, I thought I was abnormal. I thought everybody else around me is normal. They're enjoying life. And I'm going through all these internal battles, you know, and I couldn't deal with them. And then one guy at the church, I remember him. He was involved in the ministry, and I needed an assistant to help in the job I was doing in drywall taping. And so I actually had a job opening for him. Now, here was a guy that was much older in the Lord than me that I looked up to, that now I'm his boss. But I'll tell you what is amazing is that mutual friend his friendship meant so much to me because I started to open up about things I felt I was really like, well, I believe this or I'm thinking that and I don't know about this and is this weird? And man, he just set me at ease so much. He goes, ah, no problem. You know, that's normal. Don't worry about that. And hey, you know what? I want to encourage you about this. And man, I'll tell you, that friend did more for me in my growth than a year's worth of sitting in church. I want to tell you, I mean that. A whole year of sitting in church in the services did not mean as much to me as that one friend who knew the Lord really well and took me under his wing and encouraged and discipled me for just a really short time. He was only with me for about 6 months. I want to tell you something, that means a lot. Comforting a faint-hearted. Looking around and maybe someone else you can encourage, someone that maybe you're struggling and maybe they're struggling constantly and you're pouring a lot into them in the beginning. You know what? That's okay. One day they'll be able to turn around and comfort others. Uphold the weak. Now this could be the general idea that this is beyond just the weak in the church. You know, this is not the same as the faint-hearted. The weak are generally those whose, if the feeble or the faint-hearted one is one who is more emotionally unstable, this would be one that has other weaknesses, other, you know, tendencies, and you want to uphold them, you want to strengthen them, you want to challenge them. And of course, all in all, verse 14, be patient with all. You know, we're not all growing at the same rate. And we don't need to be looking down our noses at others who aren't growing as fast as we are. What we need to be is patient. Jesus was patient. You know, you challenge someone in love. You know, you don't get frustrated with them when they don't understand it after the 10th time of trying to help them. You're patient. Look at Jesus. Look at what he had to put up with. Here is the King of Kings and Lord of Lords, perfect man dealing with fishermen, tax collectors and zealots and other guys that were just the commoners of the world that they had no clue. And yet you don't see him. I mean, every now and then you'll say, oh, ye of little faith. But even then, he's exhorting them patiently. So be patient with all. And then verse 15, which I think wraps up this practical love. See that no one renders evil for evil to anyone. Now this would go to outside of the church too. You know, there are some kind of religious groups that within the religious group, you have all these constraints of how you're supposed to treat each other. But you can kill somebody outside. You can take advantage of them. You can do whatever you want on the outside. See here, I love it what he says, see that no one renders evil to anyone. Now that is probably one of the most challenging things for us because we grow up on this revenge, you know, motif. We think in terms of, you know, that bad guy getting it back. Our movies, our TV shows, you know, the Charles Bronsons and, you know, Clint Eastwood, Make My Day, you know, I mean, that's our life. We grew up on that stuff. The hero comes away, you know, he finally just beats the bad guy down good. And, you know, getting, you know, there's always something that happens where it invokes this, you know, this innocent person is killed and you're really into it now. You just can't wait for that bad guy to get it. The whole story is revolved around that. But, you know, this is not where we ought to be. There will be evil against you. Right now, let me say this. There is evil, and I say evil, that's portending our nation in regard to what our leaders are going to be voting on. Hate crimes bill is a ruse. And it scares me. Not for my sake, because I think for the most part, you know, the churches will probably be protected from this, but it scares me for your sakes. You're going to be silenced. You're going to be muzzled. Your convictions will mean nothing. Even the health care bill right now. What that's going to mean is it's going to be the largest increase to support of abortion from your tax dollars than we've had since 1973. And essentially, it's going to mandate every business to provide insurance, and the insurance companies are going to be mandated to provide for abortions. Forced. So we won't be able to find health coverage that won't also cover abortions. And it doesn't matter what your conscience. They already struck down the conscience law where if you're a person that's, you know, in a pharmacy and you don't feel in your conscience you can give out that pill that causes abortions because it's against your conscience, well, they've already said, tough luck, too bad, you have to. So you have to quit your job if you want to maintain your Christian conscience. I mean, it is more and more in your face. It is more and my consider evil. Even the cap and trade bill, this bill that's going to multiply the energy regulations, which is going to double the cost of energy. You know, something is even as economic as that, folks. It's going to dramatically affect families, and it's going to make hardships. It's going to be difficult. You're going to be losing your jobs if this thing. California, they already tried it. They thought, oh, we're going to create all these new green jobs. Instead, what it did was a lot of people lost their jobs because these companies couldn't afford to pay for the double cost in electricity. They had to let people go. And then that had a chain reaction until right now their economy is the worst in the nation. They're bankrupt. California. Thank you for showing us what we shouldn't have, but yet our leaders are going to be voting for this cap and trade bill. Listen, whether it's a cap and trade bill or the hate crimes legislation or the health care bill, you know, the funny thing is when I see this, rendered evil, no evil to evil to anyone, but always pursue what is good both for yourselves and for all. I think that has application. And not just in the areas of how you treat your neighbor. But you see, we have a privilege like no other that this statement is an indictment of our expression of love to the world. We could just say, well, it's not my business. I don't like to get involved in politics. I don't want to deal with that. But by not being involved to some degree, the silence is deafening. We're basically saying to the leaders in Washington, go for whatever you want. It won't matter to me. The Lord's coming back anyway. But if the Lord doesn't come back, what's that going to mean for our children and our children's children? And so I think that we cannot be silent on these things. Certainly not on this health care bill, which is a travesty, in my opinion. And, Pastor, you shouldn't be talking politics. You know what? It's life. It's going to mean babies die. They've already done studies that when they did not have the government funding for abortions, that 25% of the mothers that would get an abortion if they could get it for free chose to keep their baby till term. It saved lives. But there are those that have a eugenics mentality. Oh, better to get rid of those poor babies anyway because they'll just be problems. And sadly, even Christians sometimes think that way. No, these are issues that I think are greater for us. And, you know, as a Christian, the Christian response is practicing love. It's an active form. And in many ways, that's what it is. It's not about what we're not doing. Oh, I'm not hurting you. I'm not doing this to you. I'm not doing this to you. If that's your Christianity, then that's not practicing love. Love is active. How can I think about being a blessing to others? How can I influence our leaders to do the right thing so that it will affect families down the road? You know, there's a lot of people that fought the battle in California to keep marriage between a man and a woman. And it was a huge battle. And you know, the tide is moving in the other direction. In our state, they'll be voting. You know, they want to push this through in the lame duck session when no one's watching. They're going to push these bills through, and most of your representatives are going to be pressured by these groups, and they're not going to hear from you. And if they don't, then they really have nothing to go on. I get political from time to time because I do care about this nation. But listen, here's where our love needs to mostly be thinking in terms of where it's going to be. In evangelism is number one. What greater love do we have? See, because we can have all these bills pass and whatever in a good sense, and that will help society for a while, but that's not going to mean anything for eternity.